You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the situation in Iran. But right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer John K. Wilson answering a Wisconsin question about Wisconsin's capital.
Standing in the rotunda of the Wisconsin Capitol building, everything feels really big and important and majestic. You're right in the middle of Madison and right in the middle of state government. But who chose this spot to be one of the most important places in the state? Nancy from Madison wanted to know. She asked, how did the Capitol end up on the isthmus? What was the politicking that went on behind the scenes to settle on this piece of land? We talked to Bethany Brander with the Wisconsin Historical Society to help tell the story. She says that in 1836, when Wisconsin became a territory, things could have gone a lot of different ways.
There were actually 16 other locations proposed. So one was Green Bay. Another was Mineral Point. Other people wanted places that could become really great cities. So Milwaukee was one of those cities proposed because it was on Lake Michigan. It could have been a city called Wisconsinopolis, which of course doesn't exist today, or another city called Wisconsin City, which has never existed also.
So where did Madison come in? Brander says it all has to do with a politician and businessman named James Duane Doty. When territorial legislators were meeting in Belmont in southwest Wisconsin to pick a new capital, Doty went there with a plan.
So on his way to Belmont, he passes through the Four Lakes area. And conveniently in April, earlier that year, he had bought a bunch of land, which is now downtown Madison. It's the Isthmus today. And he eventually, on his way down from Green Bay, brings a surveyor with him and surveys the land, maps it out, and brings this piece of paper with him to Belmont.
On that piece of paper were the plans for this modern-looking, imaginary city Doty called Madison. And he got to work doing whatever he needed to do to sell his idea.
So when Doty gets to Belmont, it had already been known throughout the territory about the conditions that the legislators were facing at Belmont. When legislators got there, there weren't a lot of buildings, so a lot of them were crammed together in two buildings, laying on the bare floor. It was cold. Accommodations just weren't very nice. And so word got out. So when Doty arrives in Belmont, he comes with a bunch of buffalo robes. And so when he gets there, he's hanging out these buffalo robes. He's showing people his map, telling them about his paper city called Madison. And he named Madison after the recently departed President James Madison. He was kind of playing to people's patriotic sensibilities here, and it worked.
But Doty was also offering more than just buffalo robes and patriotism.
He also was offering people some real estate in Madison. He bought up all this land with his company, and he wants to make money off it. So he's letting all this land go to these people for cheap. And so by the time the final vote for the city of the new territorial capital happens, about half the legislators own land in Madison, plus the two clerks of both houses. So it kind of helped sway people's opinions to make the capital of Madison.
By 1837, construction had already started on the first Capitol building in Madison. We heard from Bethany Brander, the Southwest Sites Program Manager for the Wisconsin Historical Society, telling us how Wisconsin's capital ended up where it is. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to wpr.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm John K. Wilson.
Now, Iran's military admitted over the weekend to shooting down a passenger airliner last week, saying it mistakenly thought the plane was a cruise missile. The news is a major reversal after government leaders had said the plane crashed after technical malfunctions. And now that admission has led to more street protests in Iran, with 82 Iranians among the dead from the crash. Ishan Tharoor writes about foreign policy, geopolitics, and history for the Washington Post's Today Worldview. Ishan, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this news about the airliner. What would you tell us about this reversal from the Iranian government about shooting down that plane?
Well, it was a stunning admission. I mean, that took place over the weekend. The Iranians, after spending a couple of days essentially denying and obfuscating any direct role in the crash, when it became very clear that they would have a very hard time hiding what happened, essentially that their own air defense system took down this passenger jet, they were compelled to basically come out in the open and admit to it. And of course, as you've seen in the past 3 days, we've seen 3 days of very heated protests in Iranian cities over this. It's blown open and hold the lid all over again of a kind of huge seething amount of frustration that you see among ordinary Iranians with the regime.
And this, I know for a lot of us who woke up one morning last week to hear about the strikes that Iran had done on a couple bases in Iraq where U.S. forces were housed, and then also in the same newscast to hear about this airliner crashing and the horrible loss of life. I'm guessing that because tensions were so high, that it was probably more likely in that small window that the airliner might have been mistaken with human error as a missile in retaliation.
And that's indeed what seems to have happened. What people are really upset about was that the Iranian authorities, especially the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, this very powerful military organization that dominates large sectors of the country, and that was coordinating the what they say was a retaliatory response, this missile barrage on U.S. bases in Iraq, which in their mind was retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani that took place last week. In their view, what should have happened was that the Iranians should have grounded civilian transport at this point in time. They should have had protocols in place where such a tragedy couldn't take place. And instead, what you saw was a pretty bungled management of a system, a mistake made by a particular person in charge of a missile battery, and a really awful tragedy that led to dozens of Iranian deaths, dozens of Canadian deaths, and a genuine international tragedy.
And looking at the Iranian people, the Iranian public, it seems that first they were protesting the U.S. for the strikes against Soleimani, and then a week later protesting their own government over this and other issues. Give us a sense of what's going on with the Iranian public right now.
Well, it's a pretty dizzying time, but you can at once feel nationalism and patriotism about a man like Qasem Soleimani, who, of course, though he's seen by the U.S. as a real villain, was a rather popular icon of quote-unquote resistance to many Iranians. And you can at one time feel sympathy and support for his legacy, and at the same time also feel genuine frustration with the regime that he represents. And what you're seeing in the past few months, remember, of course, in November, there were huge rounds of protests after sparked initially by a cut to fuel subsidies and raising prices. But that really, that blew over. You saw that there is a tremendous amount of frustration with the regime. There is, of course, a lot of nationalistic pride in Iran nonetheless. And these things operate in tandem. So while, of course, we saw, potentially millions on the streets last week in honor of Soleimani, that doesn't mean that each of those people who went out there aren't also frustrated with the state of affairs within Iran. And the Iranian regime, whatever goodwill or whatever kind of national unity they may have found in the wake of Soleimani's killing, they've squandered that immediately with this really horrific accident in shooting down this passenger jet. And at the same time, you're seeing it, a lot of Iranians are fed up with the regime, are fed up with a regime that that has led to a certain kind of brain drain. You know, one of the fascinating things about what we're seeing right now is that a lot of the Iranians who died in the crash were very intelligent, educated students going overseas. And there is this kind of frustration in the country about a regime that keeps them hostage to its pretty strict draconian laws, to its kind of relative international isolation, and the death of these Iranian students going abroad almost kind of, you know, really hammers home the certain plight and alienation many Iranians feel.
We're talking right now with Ishan Tharoor. He writes about foreign affairs, geopolitics, and history for The Washington Post's Today's World View. We are talking about the most recent developments in Iran. And I want to turn to comments from President Trump this week that are getting some attention. This was about what the Trump administration has called an imminent attack that Iran was planning that ultimately led to the killing of General Qasem Soleimani. Here's Trump in an interview with Laura Ingraham on Fox last week, talking about what locations that specific attack was targeting.
But Baghdad certainly would have been the lead, but I think it would have been four embassy, could have been military bases, could have been a lot of other things too. But it was imminent, and then all of a sudden, he was gone.
On the other hand, on CBS yesterday, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper told Margaret Brennan he hadn't seen specific evidence to support that statement. Here's a listen to that.
Well, the president didn't say there was a tangible, he didn't cite a specific piece of evidence. What he said is he believed.
Are you saying there wasn't one?
I didn't see one with regard to four embassies. What I'm saying is I share the president's view that probably my expectation was they were going to go after our embassies.
Ishan, can you sort this out for us? It starts sounding very specific and then gets a lot less specific.
Well, I mean, President Trump himself has seemed to have sorted it out for us today with a tweet where he said, quote, it doesn't really matter the question of whether it was imminent or not because Qasem Soleimani had a horrible past. So from what we know and from the whole fact pattern of reporting that my colleagues and outlets elsewhere have dug up in the wake of the attack on Soleimani that killed Soleimani, what's very clear is that President Trump, once he learned of Soleimani's existence, had entertained for quite some time the prospect of taking him out in a surgical strike. This is something that has been on his mind for a while. It's been discussed in various elements of the administration. And there is a growing consensus, at least amongst experts who have been watching this and tracking this all together, that the question of imminence is really quite fuzzy. And Soleimani, of course, is a known entity. He's an incredibly shadowy but also very public figure in the sense that he's was the well-known figurehead of Iran's foreign operations, at least in the Middle East. He was somebody who was in a leadership role coordinating Iranian activities. This is all known. We don't know, and it doesn't seem particularly clear from what the administration is telling folks, what implicitly he was, or what particularly he was coordinating that would have posed an imminent threat. And it certainly seems clear now that the administration isn't so sure of it's themselves, given Esper's rather dramatic admission yesterday. And Trump's admission today that it shouldn't really matter if it was imminent or not seems to suggest that this is a strike he wanted to do no matter what, and that he sees both he sees benefit for the United States both on the international stage by taking out Soleimani, and I think probably more importantly for President Trump, this is a kind of election year win that he hopes to be touting in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, Ishan, as you said, a lot going on, kind of a dizzying pace. Thanks for bringing us up to speed.
My pleasure.
That was Ishan Tharoor, a foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post's Today's World View. He was with us to talk about the latest news coming out of Iran after the government admitted to accidentally shooting down a passenger airliner last week. It killed all of the nearly 180 civilians on board. Coming up, 2019 was another good year for the bald eagle in Wisconsin, with nest numbers in southeastern Wisconsin up 27% since 2018. We'll get the full picture from a research scientist. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Everybody loves a good comeback story, and with an increased number of nests spotted for the majority of the state, it looks like bald eagle numbers continue to grow strong in Wisconsin. Laura Jaskowitz is a research scientist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She coordinated the statewide bald eagle aerial survey effort. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith.
Let's talk first about how the survey process works. Where do these numbers come from?
The numbers come from different surveyors throughout the state. We do aerial surveys. There's a DNR pilot, an aircraft, and at least one trained surveyor in the plane. The known nests are checked from the air, and any new nests that are seen are recorded. And then at each nest, the surveyor records the condition of the nest, so they look at it and see if it looks like the nest has been repaired or if there's eagles nearby or even eagles in the nest, and that lets us know if the nest is active or not.
So it sounds like from what you're saying, Laura, that eagles tend to go back to the same place to nest year after year?
They do, yes. They are. It's very common for them to return to the same nest, or some eagles have multiple nests within their territory, so they might switch between two different nests or so, but generally they go back to the same nest.
So when these surveys first started way back in 1973, there were only 108 nests statewide, and the bald eagle was on the state and federal endangered species lists. Why were the numbers so low not that long ago?
It was due to the insecticide DDT. They banned DDT in, I believe it was the 70s, and ever since then, the eagle numbers have been recovering very well. And today, well, in 2019, there was 1,684 occupied nests throughout the state.
Wow, that is amazing. I mean, at least for me as a layperson, that sounds like a huge success story.
It is. It's really great. It's really good that the community realized that the eagle numbers were declining and that actions were taken to remove DDT, and also actions were taken to protect the nests that were found, and it was great to see them come back.
We're talking with Laura Jaskowitz right now. She's a research scientist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We are talking about the very encouraging numbers of eagle nests, bald eagle nests in Wisconsin. And as you said, Laura, 1,684 nests were spotted in 2019. That is an amazing number, looking back at that 108 nests in 1973. But actually, that 2019 number is down 11 from the year before, which was a record-setting year. Is that anything to be concerned about?
I wouldn't say it's a concern. It's probably just that the statewide numbers are beginning to stabilize, because there are still eagles moving to new areas of the state that we haven't seen nests before. So, and then it seems like overall the numbers are staying pretty stable.
Well, and talking about areas where they haven't been before, I understand that the first nest ever was spotted in Walworth County last year. That had to be a great feeling for whoever was able to find that nest.
I'm sure it was. It was really good to hear about that. And we've been hearing about a lot more nests down in southeastern Wisconsin, too. A lot of citizens have been reporting them, so that's been great.
And talking about the southeast portion of the state, the bald eagle numbers there are up 27%. That seems huge. Do you think that's partly in just spotting some that may have been there before, or is that really that much of a net increase?
It's hard to say. It could be a mixture of both things. There could have been some nests that have been there for years and other nests that are new, and it would make sense to have more new nests because the upper part of the state may be kind of hitting a carrying capacity with, especially Vilas and Oneida County, where there's the most nests throughout the state crammed into those two counties. So eagles may be trying to find different areas to nest.
So they might be spreading to find their own territory.
Yes. Yep.
And Milwaukee County is now the only county where a nest has not been spotted. Do you think there's a chance that that might happen in the future?
It's hard to say. There are some rivers that go through Milwaukee, but there's so much human development down there that it may be hard for eagles to adjust to that many people moving around. So we'll see, but we're hoping.
Well, I saw one here in Madison on a New Year's Day walk along the Lakeshore Path, which is right on the UW-Madison campus. There was an eagle out first in a tree and then out on the ice in the water. So, I mean, they do come around people.
They do. They're getting a little more bold. And I think they do generally like to keep their nests away from people, but they also are getting used to people because there's a lot of activity on lakes, and eagles love to nest near lakes, so they're most likely getting used to human activity. But I don't know if they care too much for large cities yet, like Milwaukee, where it's kind of a lot of people.
Well, Laura, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was Laura Jaskiewicz from the Department of Natural Resources talking about the rebound in bald eagle numbers. You can try a hand of viewing some eagles at the annual Bald Eagle Watching Days in Prairie du Sac and Sauk City this weekend. You can also find out how to take part in the survey at WPR.org/Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, continuing a series on health throughout the different stages of life, a physician joins host Kate Archer-Kent to discuss health for people in their 20s. They'll look at how to eat nutritiously, avoid common causes of illness, and set themselves up for continuing health in later decades. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the state is refocusing its efforts on water quality in Wisconsin as concerns over well water contamination and so-called forever chemicals continue. Two new reports were released late last week looking at how to make improvements to water quality. And today, we'll look at findings from both of them. And we're taking your calls throughout the end of the hour at 800-642-1234. Do you have issues with water quality where you live? If you use a private well, have you been able to trust the water you get from it? Or are there concerns about PFAS chemicals or lead where you live? Do you have your well tested regularly? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll start with Representative Katrina Shankland. She's a Democratic member of the State Assembly representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. She's also the vice chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Water Quality, whose report was released last week. Representative Shankland, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've been passionate about water quality for a long time. What does this issue look like in your district?
So recently, it's been about a year of studies and source contamination testing in the village of Nelsonville in the heart of my district. And 47% of the folks who live in the village of Nelsonville cannot drink their water due to nitrate contamination. That's just one example. There are other towns in Portage County that are at 25 to 30 to 40% contamination as well. And Portage County is not unique, unfortunately. There are many towns and villages in the Central Sands in Central Wisconsin where 42% or 30% of folks can't drink water from their tap. And that's something that I take very seriously. I don't want people to have to worry about how they make their cup of coffee in the morning and how they have to get bottled water during a winter snowstorm. And I think it's really important that we act to prevent contamination, as well as to address remediation and getting everyone clean water for the many folks in Wisconsin who just do not have access to it right now.
Well, there are 13 proposals for legislation in this package from the task force. Let's start with your proposal to create a new Office of Water Policy. What would that look like?
Sure. So this Office of Water Policy would be hosted within the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. And the folks at the WGNHS are hydrogeologists. They work on mapping the state's geology as it relates to our water resources, and they've been tremendous in terms of providing technical assistance to us as a task force, as well as to many projects across the state that have been dealing with contamination, where you have different counties working together to map the contamination and work to fix it. So the idea is, within the Office of Water Policy, there will be a full-time staff position to coordinate efforts on managing, conserving, protecting, and enhancing our state's water resources. And that includes looking at, you know, a liaison between the legislature, between state agencies, and helping us improve access to clean water in Wisconsin, and then providing technical assistance to other units of government as well. So it would really be another position to coordinate among all the different stakeholder groups, including the UW Institution and our state agencies and the Department of Workforce Development, so that we have a better understanding of what needs to be done on water policy in the state of Wisconsin, and that we're making sure across state agencies, across institutions like the University of Wisconsin system, for example, that we're really addressing the issue in a cohesive, comprehensive way.
And you talked about the high number of Wisconsinites who cannot drink the water that their house is provided with. Can you walk us through the part of the proposal that would increase state funding to help those Wisconsinites replace or treat contaminated wells?
Sure. So for the past few years, I've been working on reforming the Well Compensation Grant Program. This program has existed since the 80s in Wisconsin, so for decades, but so few people have access to it because the way it's structured right now, you'd be required to own livestock that uses the contaminated well in order to get the funds. So what this bill would do is it would remove the livestock requirement, and it would lower the contamination levels so that folks who are above the health standard, above 10 milligrams per liter of nitrate contamination, would have access to the program. And that is many, many people, thousands of people across Wisconsin who do not have access right now. And whenever we traveled across the state, you know, we had 14 public hearings. We heard the same thing at every public hearing. People testified that they were sick of not being able to drink their water and that they needed both a long-term solution as well as treatment and remediation options. So what the Well Compensation Grant Program bill will do is give people access to clean water, whether it's through reconstructing their well. So, for example, if, you know, the well casing is broken and needs to be fixed, retiring their well, getting a reverse osmosis system put in, bottled water temporarily while they're waiting for the long-term fix, getting a new well, or hooking up to a public utility. And that's for people above 10 parts per million, which is the federal and state health standard for nitrate. But this program also applies to folks who've got bacteria contamination and arsenic contamination too. So I'm excited that we're opening up the program up to more people.
We're talking right now with Representative Katrina Shanklin. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District. And we are talking about the proposals that have come out of the state task force looking at water quality issues. She is the vice chair of that task force. And as you mentioned, Representative Shanklin, the task force had multiple hearings across the state. What other issues did you hear from people that they are the most concerned about?
Sure. So one of the greatest issues we heard was we need to fund our county conservationists in every county. These folks are the boots on the ground, whether it's algae in the local lake, whether it's on-farm management and best practices with the local farmer who might want to prevent contamination going into the local stream or the groundwater. These are the people who really address prevention every single day, as well as remediation. And the state needs to boost our county conservation funding. So we introduced legislation to address that by providing over $3 million more in funding to county conservation programs across the state. And we heard this at almost every single hearing. And in fact, it was one of the, I believe it was the number one issue we heard. We also heard from folks who just can't get access to their water and asked us to reform the Well Compensation Grant Program, which we did. And we heard from people on the need to address a long-term strategy and solution. And so one of the things that we wanted to do as a task force was mention that we don't believe our recommendations are the end, but rather the beginning. We want to continue this work through the legislature, knowing that over a year of work and 14 public hearings and thousands of miles around the state, we heard many different ideas and issues from folks, and we addressed many of them with 13 bills. But we also know we have more work to do. So I want to make that very clear. I think the task force did a great job putting together these bills and addressing the issues that we heard from many folks about. But I also know that this work must continue and that it cannot end within this legislative session. So I'm very committed to continuing this work beyond this next year.
This is not a period of time in the state or in the nation where bipartisanship is often successful, but it seems like this task force, Republicans and Democrats, have been working very well together. What do you attribute that?
I attribute it to the willingness to work together, to listen to our constituents, to travel across the state, and the fact that, first of all, this clean water should never be a partisan issue, and second of all, it is such a personal and emotional issue for our constituents who don't have access to clean water. And we should not be relying on bottled water for current and future generations. And so I think I want to credit the many people across the state who showed up to our public hearings and who've been organizing on this issue for a very long time, who've been flagging it as an incredibly important issue for the people of the state of Wisconsin, because it's their work that's gotten us here. And again, I think we need to be committed to doing much more. I think we need to be working on the next state budget and getting as much water quality initiatives, as many water quality initiatives as we can in the budget. But in the meantime, I've been very, very pleased with the collaboration. I think it speaks to the power of people of Wisconsin who've made this their issue and asked us to work together.
Obviously, as you said, the budget is going to be a big factor in this. Are there some steps that can be taken to make some of these proposals a reality before they get put into a next budget cycle?
Yeah, so the bills have been introduced and they're currently circulating for co-sponsorship, and many of them have strong bipartisan support, whether it's a pilot program to reduce nitrate contamination altogether, or whether it's our county conservationist funding, our well compensation program. I'm really excited about the support. If people like these ideas and want to see them get signed into law, I would encourage them to reach out to their state senator and state representative and ask them to co-sponsor the bill so that we have as many people who've endorsed it publicly as possible on the bill early. And then from there, you know, testify at the public hearings, help us get these bills past the finish line, and let's keep working on clean water.
Before we let you go, Representative Shanklin, last week was a big week for water quality reports. The governor also released a report with the DNR on water quality. This was part of his Year of Clean Drinking Water initiative. How do you see his proposals and the DNR's proposals working along with the goals of the task force?
I view it as supplementary and complementary. I think it's important that the legislature and executive branch and state agencies all work together. And although the governor had DACAP, the Agriculture Department, the Department of Health Services, and the Department of Natural Resources at all 14 of our hearings, providing us with scientific information about the issues and their recommendations. And we took many of their recommendations and acted on them, and it's my hope to continue acting on their recommendations. So some of our bills mirror their recommendations and their report that they issued both in October and January. And I'm looking forward to continuing to work with them and appreciate their insights and expertise.
Well, Representative Shanklin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Representative Katrina Shanklin, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. She was with us today to talk about the findings from a state task force looking at water quality issues in the state and to talk about what comes next. In a moment, we'll look at the report on water quality from Governor Tony Evers and the DNR. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about water quality in Wisconsin. The legislature and Governor Evers released two separate reports looking at the issue last week. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is water quality like where you live? Do you live in an area where there are concerns about PFAS or lead contamination? Or do you get your water from a private well? What do you want to see your state government do to improve water quality, if anything? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Todd Ames joins us now. He's the Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Department of Natural Resources, and he's with us to talk about Governor Evers' Year of Clean Drinking Water report. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So what were some of the steps taken by the Evers administration to deal with clean drinking water last year?
The very beginning of the year, the governor, one of his first acts as the new governor of the state, announced that 2019 was the year of clean drinking water, and immediately began to put together a series of proposals that would be part of the state budget. So there were a number of those proposals that actually made it into the state budget, and so that began the effort. But we have been focused for the last 12 months in three different areas, looking at the challenges of lead service lines in with water utilities in the state, looking at issues associated with these human-made chemical compounds, as you mentioned, referred to as PFAS, and then also looking at things like nitrates and pathogens that are contaminating drinking water, private wells and drinking water supplies. And so the number of things that we've steps that we've taken in each of those three areas that's detailed in this report. But I think equally important is driving home a point in this report that certainly we've got a lot more work to do, that it took us many years of, in some cases, neglect with our systems to get us to where we are today, and we're going to have to do a lot more moving forward. And so this lays out what are the steps that we're doing to move forward so that we can make sure that any Wisconsinite in the state, no matter where they are, can be confident that when they turn the tap, that the water is safe to drink.
Well, let's zero in on those three big areas. The first, the lead contamination. Drinking water. Certainly, we've heard a lot about that out of Milwaukee County. That was a huge issue and continues to be in Flint, Michigan. How long should Wisconsinites expect before they can live in places that are completely free of lead in their water?
Well, it's depending on where you are, you may already be there. The city of Madison actually has already replaced all of its lead service lines. There's about 10 other communities in the state that are making some good substantive progress and actually have local ordinances to deal with it. But in other areas of the state, it's going to take a while. We have about 200,000 lead service lines in the state in about 130 communities, and it's going to cost money and take time to get those lines replaced. Now, in the short term, the good news is that as long as those communities are using various treatment technologies on those lead service lines, in the short term, there's no lead that is coming from those pipes into people's drinking water supplies. But longer term, the only long-term safe way to make sure that we don't have those problems is to get the lead out. And so that effort will move forward over a period of years. And one of the things we've been working to do is to get more funds available, both state and federal funds available to those local communities so that they are able to offset some of the cost of removing those lines so that it doesn't fall entirely on the backs of the local water utility ratepayers.
Talking with Todd Ames right now. He's Assistant Deputy Secretary at the DNR. We're talking about the Governor's Year of Clean Drinking Water report. And Todd, you know, it seems like all of a sudden we're hearing the term PFAS left and right. Tell us first briefly what those are and how the DNR is planning on dealing with those chemicals.
So this is a suite of chemical compounds that we've been manufacturing this company in this country for several decades. Although the older form of these are the ones that we have the most research out and suggest that they have the most potential for causing harm with low birth weights in children, links to possible carcinogens, et cetera. And these compounds were originally made to make water slide off from various surfaces. So think Teflon pans, think Scotch Guard, think various sorts of surfactants and manufacturing facilities. And unfortunately, now we've got those contaminants out there. Another big area of those is firefighting foam, which does a very good job of putting out chemical fires, but also can create some contamination. So there's a huge effort underway, not only in our state, but in several other states around the country. And we are right in the process of moving forward with getting standards on the books in Wisconsin to have drinking water standards, surface water standards, and groundwater standards to make sure that we know when we've got a contamination problem and then we can actually move forward with cleanup.
Let's take a quick call from Stephen in New Glarus. Hi, Stephen.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hello. Oh, yeah, I own property up in Ashland County, and I can't use the water there at all.
And why is that?
Well, it's an old problem that's always been there, and I'm not sure there's much anything can be done about it, but the Amish community next to me, the Amish don't have holding tanks for their septic system for human waste. They use outhouses, and they allow the waste to go into the ground.
And we'll have to leave it there, Stephen. We're a little short on time. But Todd, we certainly have issues with animal waste as well, also pesticides. Stephen's saying also human waste. That's a whole other category.
Yeah, I would say overall, I mean, that when you're talking about private wells and drinking water supplies, I think for all of your listeners, the key thing to think about here is we have a variety of contaminants that are causing problems in those wells, and we've got to get a better handle on what is causing that contamination and also what can be done to both address the source and also deal with when you've got a contaminated well. One of the reasons this is such a big deal in Wisconsin is that we have a lot more private wells that provide drinking water to our residents. Nationally, about 10% of the people in the country get their drinking water from private wells. In Wisconsin, it's closer to one-third of our households in the state. So because of that, it's all the more important that we focus on where are the problems, what's causing the contamination, and what can we do to eliminate it moving forward. So that's why we've focused on that, and there's a whole effort that the Evers administration has launched to focus on things like nitrate and pathogen contaminations, those things that are getting into the wells and causing problems that makes the drinking water unsafe.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and have a nice rest of your day.
You too. That was Todd Ames, Assistant Deputy Secretary at the DNR. He was with us today to talk about the Governor's Year of Clean Drinking Water report. Earlier in the segment, Representative Katrina Shankland, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, was with us. We talked about the findings from a state task force looking at water quality issues. If you want to find out more about either of the two reports we looked at today, you can find more information linked on our website, WPR.org/Central Time. And for more information, go to wiscontext.org and check out their drinking water quality series. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, House Democrats are meeting tonight and tomorrow about the next steps in the impeachment process. We'll bring you up to speed. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 7:30, according to CNBC, retailers shut down more than 9,300 store locations last year. That's a 50% increase in total closures from 2018. A retail analyst joins host Kate Archer-Kent to share an outlook on the retail industry in the upcoming year and what that could mean in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then there's good news on the medical front. U.S. cancer deaths saw the largest ever single-year drop, and that's in large part because of advances in lung cancer treatment and fewer people smoking. We'll learn where cancer prevention and treatment stands in the U.S. and Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Rob Ferret will be back tomorrow. This is Central Time.
I'm Demi from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and my employer, American Family Insurance, matches my sustaining gift to WPR. It was really easy. I just filled out the paperwork, and they said, congratulations, we're sending the money to double your donation to Wisconsin Public Radio. I think American Family is proud to partner with their employees. They find value in the same things that we find important. There'll be more value to my donation to WPR.
Do you need a break from 24/7 wall-to-wall politics?
Just a few moments ago.
Just minutes ago.
Breaking news tonight.
We begin with major news.
Yeah, me neither. So join us for the WPR Politics Podcast, where we sort through all the latest in Wisconsin state politics to help you decide what's interesting and important. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts, and at WPR.org/politics.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. After a delay by the House of Representatives, President Trump's impeachment trial will move forward this week. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on what's ahead.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.